When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Saving money on everything for your next project at Menards. It doesn't matter what job you're up against. Works cordless power tools and lawn equipment have the power for you to get the job done faster and easier. The PowerShare 20-volt batteries run longer on a single charge, and they can be used with other tools. Check out Menards' entire selection of Works cordless power tools and lawn equipment. Plus the weekly flyer today on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Anyway, she goes to bed. I open up a box of Vibes. I light up. I pour myself a cognac. And I watch the 14 fists of McCluskey. What a picture.
Yo, homie, is that my briefcase?
And start asking the right fucking questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the One Heat Minute Patreon podcast. I'm your host, Blake Howard. This show is a bonus series that, you know, probably 3 to 6 months later may find its way to our main feed, just simply because I love my guests so much that come on and talk to me about stuff. But you are exclusively hearing it here first. My guest today is one of my favorites that I get to talk to on the show. We always look forward to talking to each other in some capacity. And what you're going to start seeing is something that I've kind of been keeping under wraps, which is working on some of my favorite films from a decade ago, doing a little thing I'm calling the Decade Project, where I'm just going back into the films of 2013, exactly 10 years ago, to dive through some of the big ones, but also some of the ones that mean the most to me and I feel like have endured. The man I'm talking to today is the wonderful Isaac Fellberg. You've heard him on here talking to me about Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. He's a critic and an editor and a really phenomenal interviewer that you're going to find across a whole bunch of stuff. As I'm staring at his face right now, he's bleary-eyed. He's got Sundance hangover. Bless him so much for taking time away from like 25 assignments to come back and talk to me about a 2013 movie that was so fun at the time because it was incredibly divisive. And on one side, you had people like the sensational, like Manola Dargis, who was like talking about, I guess, the dread and this moral quandary that this movie came up with and this like excess, this contemporary Gomorrah. And then you just had a whole bunch of people who eviscerated it and hated it. And what's been brilliant over the last decade, as all the films I'm going to talk about in this little series, is that it has gained this incredible, enduring life in our pop culture, which is that it's kind of memeified, but whenever you mention it, people sneak out under the mat and they're like, oh, I'm down for this movie. So the movie is The Counselor.
Will you?
Yes, I will.
I intend to love you until I die.
Me first.
Counselor.
My back's against the wall, man.
Money problems are serious problems.
I will set it up.
625 kilos, we're probably looking at 20 million.
I know why I'm in it. Do you?
It's a nice ring. Want to know how much it's worth?
I always thought a law degree was a license to steal,
but you hadn't really capitalized on it.
I'm really worried, baby.
It's gonna be all right.
If you pursue this road that you've embarked upon, you will eventually come to moral decisions that will take you completely by surprise.
You should be careful what you wish for.
You might not get it.
Counselor,
we've got a problem.
The shipment, it's gone.
I had a call from our business partners. These people are out 20 mil.
They think we're all involved, don't they?
No, just you, Counselor, you. They don't believe in coincidences. They've heard of them. They've just never seen one.
You're in trouble. When the axe comes through the door, I'll already be gone.
What do you think I should do?
How bad is it?
We're all done here.
It's too late.
I can vanish in a heartbeat. Can you?
The slaughter to come is probably beyond our imagining.
You are the world you have created. And when you cease to exist, this world that you have created will also cease to exist.
My guest is a great Isaac Thalberg. I think he's going to be back for a few of these because I know that he, like me, we kind of like was starting reviewing films properly around this time. Isaac, thank you so much for being a part of the show again, my man. I really appreciate you. How have you been?
Blake, thank you for having me. I'm always happy to step away from the Sundance fever, which does feel like an actual, like, you know, medical fever to see you and to talk about a movie that I adore, The Counselor. And it's exactly to what you're saying. It's one of those movies that starts conversations wherever it goes. Watching that movie, like just imagining that movie coming out in 2013, the responsibilities of the studio to sell this Western that is just this series of like dense philosophical monologues and brutal murders. It's delightful. You know, I love it very dearly.
I remember sitting in an audience I was sitting next to two or three other film critics. And I remember one of those things, you know, when you kind of like feel like you're in a hostile enemy position in a war zone where there's like four of you guys and there's like 300 people trying to get into whatever position you're in. And so you're just holding fort and you're just waiting for the doors to burst. That's what it felt like, because I was watching this movie, thoroughly enjoying the contrast that it was playing with and its kind of self-awareness of like, we're creating this opulent drug trade. And if anyone had even a passing familiar with Cormac McCarthy, I'm like, oh, this is all going to hell. Do we not understand it's all about to go to hell? And I was enjoying like, oh, look at it. And people are like, oh, it's opulent, it's silly, these people are having philosophical conversations. And I'm like, well, that's the whole thing, is this penetrating, sometimes literally penetrating thing where it's examining opulence, drugs, like thinking that you can be above the law, and then singular mistakes in this world have ramifications and consequences that are just not in real life and not there. And oh man, I was so down for it. And I just remember walking out and people like that whole, like you're walking out of the theater conversation. Yep. People were eviscerating it. And I was just sort of sitting silently waiting for my turn. And then people were like, hey man, that was bad, right? And I was like, no, that was amazing. I loved that. I loved every frame of that. That was so fun. I had a great time. And people were like, what are you talking about? How did you like that? I'm like, well, you'll have to wait because I've got some thoughts, you know, I've got some thoughts about this thing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those movies that you do either get on its wavelength immediately and you're tapped into this, you know, very, this very, you know, theatrical, but also very brooding and apocalyptic sort of tenor to the conversations. And it's like, it's very ornate and it's very, I said dense, but also it's very cryptic. You know, the conversations that these characters are having are not straightforward. They are, you know, remarkably verbatious characters.
Yes.
They speak in these like grandiloquent stanzas of calling on like, you know, Antonio Machado to make a like, you know, you've got like these, you know, characters who are, you know, they are drug dealers. They are involved with the cartel there, but they're also in this business world. And there's this sort of sheen of professionalism that I think is so, so key to what, you know, our titular counselor, poor Michael Fassbender, the star of the show, the man of the hour, that, you know, it really lures him in a way, because he's like, oh, you know, these guys are surrounded by signifiers of their wealth and of their success. I'm going to, you know, meet with diamond dealers in this as well. Like, and, you know, that's the kind of the conversations I'm comfortable with. And he, I don't think, is prepared for, you know, what's beneath all of that dialogue and beneath all of the back and forth over these, you know, kind of highfalutin, almost like mythological concepts, which is like just a very savage, clinically efficient killing machine of an operator. there's this brutality to it that I think is there. It's a razor edged movie. I think in the way it plays with these characters talking to each other and what they really mean when they're saying all of these things.
Yeah, everything's, you know, every concept also, it's like you just touched on something for me, which I think happens and is really real. And obviously it's incredibly heightened in this movie, but people use intelligence as class, you know, because in these areas where to even get in the rooms, you have to have money. You have to elevate it from like, am I old money? Am I new money? Am I dirty money? And the intelligence is almost laundering the money that they're dealing with in these situations. They're like, I'm philosophically thoughtful. I'm deep. Yes, I'm crass and I'm gross and I'm over the top. And everything about Javier Bardem's like hair and outfits and overly incredibly affrontingly white teeth are just so perfect with how it's all structured. And even with, I mean, this is my maybe equal favorite Cameron Diaz performance ever. Like Cameron Diaz, like she's just complete like instrument of sex and power. And yet she'll have lots of like, what is the life that you're even living? Like some of her lines are like the most Anton Chigurh lines with like Penelope Cruz. Like you live in a dream. Like she's almost like you live in a dream world. Like this is insane. And it's so great. And I just had such, I had, and I continue to have such a great time watching this because like I was watching it again. I watched the whole film recently and I've just been picking apart through scenes and it's almost in the extended cut because has a bunch of additional footage, a bunch of additional scenes, and even a couple of the deleted scenes didn't make the extended director's cut. But thanks to one of our patron CK, who loves cataloging scripts and deleted scenes and what gets left on the floor.
Yeah.
But he, it's about an hour in after all this stuff's happening and it's all this foreboding. And then when it actually starts breaking down, it's the palette of the movie changes. There's no more color or life or anything. It's just everything feels like death is coming. And at the very worst that you get, you also go, oh my God, it's even worse than that. It's even worse than I could have imagined that it's going to get.
It completely has that quality to it. I think that, you know, in talking about The Counselor, this is a Ridley Scott movie and it is a beautifully made one, but it is also a Cormac McCarthy movie.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, part of what I should just disclose up front in talking about The Counselor is that Cormac McCarthy is probably my favorite author, at least like my favorite living author. I think that he has a style that is completely his own. You know, actually, no, I think he has multiple styles that are completely his own. And I think that he moved between them with this like incredible, you know, kind of almost like fire and brimstone level of intensity of purpose. Like he is just, he is God to to the worlds that he creates. And, you know, I think that
and he's a vengeful God.
He's a wrathful God. And, and he is very Old Testament in his, you know, in his addresses, his decrees, but he is best known for Westerns and for, you know, apocalyptic novels like The Road. And I think that The Counselor is, as you know, Cormac McCarthy's for like spec script that he just, you know, wrote. It is like that, you know, has made its way into this incredible film. It's an apocalyptic Western. It is, you know, a movie about, you know, this frontier and about frontier violence and about the idea and the inanity of the idea of frontier justice, anything that, you know, the American West had once played with, or that landscape of cowboys and gunslingers and proprietors. And I think that in pretty much every way, The Counselor takes that kind of language, that mythology, and it also, it brings to bear on it this, you know, just storm cloud of violence and destruction and reckoning. And you mentioned Anton Chigurh earlier, and I think that that's kind of the tell. There's always a sociopath in these movies. And I think Cameron Diaz plays that role quite beautifully and zanily and just completely to the hilt in The Counselor. But I think that, you know, there is that character who is very clear-eyed about the reckoning to come and positioning themselves as being the one who's meting out punishment as opposed to receiving it. But I just remember that line in No Country for Old Men where Javier Bardem is talking about an accounting that will come. You know, he's like, what's the most you've ever lost in a coin toss? Like, he knows, like, the worst thing that can happen, it is going to happen eventually. And it's like, I think that
because the odds always go to zero in the, like,
yeah,
the odds always go to zero. That's the Cormac McCarthy modus operandi. I want to mention for folks. So, you know, we're kind of in Cormac McCarthy fever right now. We've got two new books in a single year. I've just picked up one of them over the weekend. So very happy to actually finally dive into that. And there was a time here where Cormac McCarthy was on the hook to deliver a manuscript from his representatives who had been waiting because there was no one bigger in the literary world after No Country for Old Men wins an Oscar and had been adapted by the Coen brothers in such a sort of offbeat way. You know, they were like, we're going to adapt two authors, Homer and Cormac McCarthy. Like, that's the only authors we're going to adapt. And then later, you know, Shakespeare, even if it was just one of the brothers that actually did it. But he then just rolls into a meeting with a spec script. I haven't written a novel, I've written a script. And then it became obviously the hottest property in the world. So in sort of 2012, when it emerged that this movie was going to be made, and just the hitters that are in this movie, you know, Fassbender, who was the hottest actor in the world at the time, Penelope Cruz, Javier Bardem, Cameron Diaz, you name it. It had this immense and like salivating worthy script. Brad Pitt's there. John Leguizamo pops up for a hot minute. Like, it's like, there's so many
Bruno
of these.
Bruno
Gantz.
Like, Bruno Gantz.
We have to talk about that scene. But it just became this thing that I think a whole bunch of people were expecting to be one thing. And I think if anyone had even a tiniest sense of who Cormac McCarthy was as a creative, you're like, oh no, this is not going to be this glitzy, poppy pulp crime thing. It's going to be deeply philosophical, and it's going to hit and murder harder than most things, because it's going to be ruthlessly brutal. And I think that that's what he gets. That's why that frontier, that borderlands crime is so fascinating. It's because you're facing two completely different paradigms and perspectives of law and order. And there's, you know, one side of the fence prescribing to law in some senses, and across the border being order. And that conflict is, they're not the same thing. They're not going for the same thing. They don't operate on the same level. They don't have the same structures. Going back to another film that I love is like Last of the Mohicans. There's someone who wrote this incredible essay for the book, The Philosophy of Michael Mann, was pointing out the great conflict of Mohicans is that you're operating with three judicial systems at the same time. You've got the Indian judicial system, you've got the emerging America's judicial system, you've got British judicial systems fighting with one another because they all have different purposes and different gods. And so I think these borderlands crime dramas are so fascinating because you're just working with these two paradigms. They're instantly in conflict from the second you start the movie, and then all these other little parasitic entities that are around them trying to figure it out are all just trying to get what they can out of this system.
And I think it's such an interesting movie about systems and about, you know, the way that people can operate within them, because I think it also gives these characters the measure of their decisions. Like, you know, there is weight to the choices that are made by the characters in this movie, but there's also, to your point, just this this understanding that you need to have to get out unscathed. Like, you know, there's this whole kind of element to it where people just don't pay attention enough, like, you know, to what's going on around them. And then it's too late by the time they kind of understand what the score is. But I think that one of the more brutal things about the movie is that there is this like kind of element of like, oh, it's too late to escape because you thought that you were on top of this and you weren't, and now you're going to die. Or now, you know, the worst possible thing is going to happen. And there, I can't remember which character it is who gives the like, as the world gives way to darkness speech. But like, I mean, they all do at different points.
I was just going to say, it's hard to track that because everyone kind of says that at any given point in the movie.
Yeah, but it's late in the movie, and he's like, you know, the understandings of the world is in fact oneself. Like that whole idea, like you create the world that you live in. And, you know, it is the sum of your decisions. This, and so as it is kind of collapsing into darkness, you need to have an accounting, not just for the system, but for your role within it and the thing that you have kind of done to bring yourself here. And I think that that's a real McCarthy thing. Like, you know, it's Anton Chigurh as well. He's like, you're going to make a choice and then you're going to either die or live. And, you know, it doesn't really matter how. And he reduces it to that, you know, that coin toss idea where you're like, wow, like it would. And like Carla Jean at the very end challenges him on that. He's just like, you know, it's like, no, this isn't fair. Like you're the guy who's doing the coin toss. And he's like,
but that's his hack. That's almost his hack for that. It's like, It's like
the guy who wants to go get the pizza because he like does the
life lives and dies by the coin toss. And then it's almost like Shigure kind of awoke with the idea of like, what if I'm the one tossing the coin? And that's it. That's what if I'm the one who's refereeing life and death. There are so many coin tosses in this movie, but let's go back quickly because we just talked about the wonderful Bruno Gantz, who at this time also had been incredibly hot property. Yeah. Just coming off playing Hitler in his last days, which has been endlessly memed, which is kind of strange also. Like it's memed to death, but it's very strange. And then he comes into this movie as this sweet, kind of adorable, kind of fastidious man.
Yeah.
Who, especially in the extended cut, has this huge monologue about culture and cultural shifts and this like postmodern idea that there's no culture. And he's doing it all through the prism of diamonds and all through the prism of Jewish culture. And it is a really, like, I love when casting makes a scene even more stuffed with, you know, philosophy than obviously the philosophy that they're saying in the scene or the, you know, the performances. It is such an incredible scene of like, you know, diamonds come and go. And what's the ultimate destiny for this stone? It's that it survives and it was here before we realized it was here. And now we have it, this flawless thing that nature has created. And it's going to outlive and outsurvive us all. And it's going to have this, it's just going to be this refraction, this interpreter of everything, all the joy and love that it brings to the world, but also it's probably going to bear witness to some absolute gnarliness, which is me just completely chunking and trying to summarize and synthesize the theme of the scene. But that's a scene that I go back to and I'm like, I can't believe this scene exists because it's so perfectly calibrated for what the philosophy of this movie is.
I think Michael Fassbender should be forever grateful that he got to do that scene with
Bruno.
It's like, you know, he was remarkable. I mean, like, he would even, I mean, Bruno Gans has just had too many roles to name, but you know, he is just so good at that, as that, either that old spook or just that old guy who is, he has lived long enough to kind of know what the score is to what we were saying. But, you know, also what he says about the diamond in that scene that is so compelling as well. He's like, you know, the purpose of adornment is, you know, you're wearing the stone for a time and the stone will outlive you, but it also calls attention to the fact that you won't outlive the stone. It calls attention to both the beauty and the power of your temporary life, like your frailty. That idea is like very much in The Counselor. It's like, you know, for how long can you fly close to the sun? For how long can you live the life of this immortal being, you know, untouchable in your palace? And I think it really it is quite incisive about that, about like, you know, the opulence of the rich being a rental
for
individual person. And you know, you're never going to really know when your time is up with it, but someone else is going to move in as soon as you're, you know, as soon as you're like writhing on the floor of the polo.
We'll be right back after this little break.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Saving money on everything for your next project at Menards. It doesn't matter what job you're up against. Work's cordless power tools and lawn equipment have the power for you to get the job done faster and easier. The PowerShare 20-volt batteries run longer on a single charge, and they can be used with other tools. Check out Menards' entire selection of Work's cordless power tools and lawn equipment. Plus, the weekly flyer today on Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
There was something that my my brother and sister, who I just call my brother and sister, actually half brother and sister, because their mum, when they were growing up, passed away from cancer, and then my mum and dad got together, and you know, we recreated our family unit. So for like my whole life, if people are like, "Oh, that's your half brother," I didn't play that shit. But that's my brother and sister, and my sister recently had a whole bunch of jewelry that belonged to her mum. Yeah. And like old tacky, as you would probably expect, you know, we're not like this opulent, well-off family, but like old tacky 70s and 80s jewelry, if you like. And she had it smelt down like a bunch of these old pieces that belonged to her mum into this beautiful, quite plain bracelet. And I really, you know, some people might find the sentimental value in the individual pieces, but I found it quite beautiful that she was kind of taking all of these memories and binding and bounding herself to them with this new thing that was hers. And it kind of was like, it was that. And that's what I kept thinking about when I watched this. I was like, oh my God, I've had this like little own personal thing. It's just like, you have these things that in that moment, at that time in her mother's life, were these incredible tokens of like love and gifts and family and all those things and whatever the hell they were. And then they transition into these other things, which are like, oh, these are, you know, these are more than that. They're different and they're evolving. And I kept thinking that when I was watching that Bruno Gantz scene, it's like, again, it's particularly apt with the council, I feel, to get as philosophical as possible, but like a diamond refracting light is how you find its value. It's how you find its clarity, and light passing through it is obviously a beam that is transitioning through, and how the light refracts out of it or the clarity with which it does it to be graded and all those sorts of things. So it is about all the things that you bring to it and then all the things that pass after you. And I feel like the whole movie is a nexus of that. It's like, this is all the stuff we're bringing to it, and this is how it refracts out of it and shows you the consequences of what it is. But that thing is just going to keep passing on. And so I love that, because then there's guilt and consequence, and the morality is there, because the challenge in the extended cut that Bruno Gantz gives to Fassbender is that, like, you know, we were a warrior culture with the ancient Greeks. We're a culture of compassion and gods, you know, and like Western ideological church perspectives in the Western world. Now we're moving into a time of no culture, and the diamond is a totem of all of that. And so it feels like, at least having this really big philosophical question, exactly as you said, it's like, the diamond's the coin toss. It's like, it's everything that this movie is.
And, you know, it's amazing that, you know, we meet the counselor when he's going to that diamond dealer to get the engagement ring for her. And he's obsessed with the symbol. He's obsessed with the idea of attaining this kind of symbol of wealth, but also this, like, you know, and I think that he has a very different idea about what a diamond is before that. with Bruno Ganz. And I don't think he understands either.
No.
He's engaged in that conversation, but I don't think he understands what Bruno Ganz is saying.
He's going to school as an actor and as a character.
Completely.
Because Steve McQueen said that Fassbender is like one of the best contemporary actors. And I would have to agree, because so many of his performances is so wonderful. But there's an effortlessness that some of these older actors, you know, it's a Bruno Ganz or a Donald Sutherland or Isabelle Huppert or someone like that. Like, they get to a level where they can just exist. And you're it's something transcendent about it. You're like, oh, they're just existing. Look at how they can just be in a scene.
There's a difference between, you know, there's a difference between working hard and between understanding, right?
Yes.
Which is, you know, and there's a difference between, you know, being talented and working hard and being a pro. And I think that, you know, that understanding is what Bruno Ganz has. And I think he's just so perfect for that part, because he's trying to impart this kind of like this very arcane wisdom that, you know, Michael Fassbender is just not prepared for, because he doesn't come from that world. He's a lawyer. It's like, you know, he's used to kind of dealing with the minutiae of these details and of like every transaction, but he's not really thinking about the big picture at all. But like, even like, you know, before that scene, you see that motorcyclist just like kind of heading out. And, you know, he's heading toward what the counselor is going to do. Like, and, you know, that's like, that character is just, that part is already in play.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it, I think that this movie does have a lot in it about fate. And I think that, you know, when you think about that scene in context later, like the diamond dealer scene, where it's like, you know, he's so desperate to find this like kind of token of his affection for Laura. Like, and we should talk about the sex scene as well.
Laura.
It's so interesting, because I often see that pointed to as one of the film's weaknesses, is its conception of Laura as being this kind of holy sort of presence in a way, even though she's saying some, you know, or she's inviting some pretty explicitly sexual things, like in that scene, and especially in the extended cut of the film, that scene goes on for a bit longer and there's a bit more from her toward him. But I think that, and it's also like the whitest sheets I've ever seen in my life.
There have never been whiter sheets in almost anything I've ever seen. That's like when you go to like a really if you're ever lucky enough to stay in a fancy hotel or save up and go for a special anniversary, that's like one thing that when you go to like these places, it's like a million thread count or whatever it is, because they're always very opulent, but they're like so white, and you're like,
yeah,
you know, I got two kids, like I just know that some kid's gonna come in and like dirty up.
Somehow, like, just by being here.
We can't have them in here. Like, one night a grubby kid's gonna come and sneak into my bed, and then maybe have a night terror and have an accident, and then those sheets are going in the bin. I'm not doing any of that. So it's just one of those hilarious things where you're like, but no, it's an amazing scene. They're just completely into each other. I love that she's a little bit old, like age appropriate. Like, she's age appropriate. She has all this sexual agency. She's kind of releasing herself, even though she's this quiet, stoic religious person by admission. And then they have this amazing, you know, I think Manola Dargis in a review said like that they whisper sweet, dirty nothings to one another, which I just love that turn of phrase. It's just like, it's terrific.
And it's like, it's so immediate, and it just exists in a realm of its own, like outside of it. And I think that so much of what Cormac McCarthy does with that character is that she is the untouchable.
Yes.
She's like, you know, somehow she's not the virgin, because, you know, they're definitely, you know, getting up to some stuff in there. But at the same time, she has this purity, and she's above what the counselor digs into.
Yes.
And I think that he sees her as worthy of this diamond because of that. but he's so kind of, he idealizes her in that way as well. And he discounts her and her presence as well as being physically there. I think, like, you know, that line, which keeps coming up, it's kind of the line of the movie of, like, you know, you think that you can, you think you can be in the world without being a part of it,
or yes,
not be a part of it. But, like, I think he thinks of Laura in the world as this, like, you know, angelic, gorgeous being who he is with, but he doesn't really see that she could be caught up in anything that he's doing until it's too late. And I think that there is a lot of, I always think of the scene in The Gray where Liam Neeson's wife in that movie is just, like, also in the sheets. And then she gets, like, kind of pulled away because he wakes up and he's, like, in the snow. Have you seen
One of my favorite movies almost ever.
Mine too. I love The Gray.
I love The Gray.
They're kind of in conversation as these, like, philosophical sort of pieces about, you know, what the will to survive means and, you know, where it factors in or doesn't with either nature or, in this case, law and order. I love The Gray.
Let's bookmark this time in this conversation is a promise that Isaac and I will be back to talk about The Gray in so much more detail than just us gushing about The Gray. The Gray, like the counselor, just shows our proximity to death. Like, I've spoken to a few people about this. One of my favorite trips of all time, I've gone to Africa twice, and I said, Africa is the realest place on earth. And people are like, what does that even mean? Right. You know, are you a Cormac McCarthy character, Blake? Like, what are you talking about? And what I say is the reality of existence where you see, like, extreme poverty, you know, or layers of poverty, or, like, extreme poverty and then extreme opulence, you know, Cape Town, that has a lot of, has this incredible, like, I guess there's these huge communities of low, like, extreme low socioeconomic communities that are all bundled together on one side of Cape Town. And then you get to Cape Town, the town in South Africa, the city, and then you go over to the coastline, which, you know, to the actual Cape, and it almost feels like a Grecian town. It's all these white homes. It's, you know, the Charlize Theron, Leonardo DiCaprio holiday home places that are there, and it's extreme wealth. And so you've got extreme wealth, a small, like, mountain range. You've obviously got, you know, some of the geographical boundaries, like physical boundaries in your way, and then you've got poverty. And I'm like, you've got poverty, you got this, and then you've also got the wrinkle of a whole bunch of animals that if you accidentally walk out of your home one night by accident, you know, there's an elephant nearby that's with a baby elephant, and you could immediately be seen as a threat. And then it's all over for you. You know, I remember there was a time I was in a tent in Botswana, and they're like, okay, if you need to go to the bathroom, gentlemen, in the middle of the night, I just need you to open your tent flap and go to the toilet, like, out of your tent.
Yeah, completely.
And ladies, if you also need to go, you need to basically just stand just enough outside of your tent and go to the toilet, like, immediately in your tent. I know it might sound gross, but you've just got to go there and then get back in your tent. And they're like, why? And they're like, well, because where we're camping on this little island in this sort of archipelago, hippos will be out of the water at night. And they look at your tent and they basically see a rock. But if they see a person and they feel a threat, you just got to kind of be mindful of it. And I just remember going, like, that's not a problem that I have in Sydney.
No.
this is like even camping in Australia, like, obviously, like, snakes, spiders, you know, those sorts of things. Maybe crocodiles if you're in certain parts of the Northern Territory or in Northern Australia. But it's like, you would be very aware of it. There'd be signage everywhere. There'd be rangers. There'd be all this stuff because, you know, of just the infrastructure of our Western society. But I'm like, it's the realest place on earth because it's the closest I've ever felt to being unsafe or being like that, just at a passing familiarity. And that's what I feel with, like, The Gray. It's like, you're there and it's like, oh, it's life and death. And, like, if you get an injury, you're dead.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
it's that
Yeah, it's that simple. And in The Counselor, if you are imperfect, back to our diamond exchange and how important that conversation, if you're imperfect, you're dead.
Yeah, I'm back to you know, Brad Pitt in that movie as well. Like the guy who's like, you know, don't take fucking notes on this, like to Fassbender at the beginning. Like, and he seems like he knows what's up, but like, you know, if he's off by a hair, then he's miscalculated something and that's disastrous.
Yes.
And I think that there's something that is very real about that. It's so funny you're talking about feeling like having had that experience, because I always think of Australia as the place where all of the wildlife is trying to kill you.
even as an Australian, Africa is another kettle of fish, is all I would say. It's like in Australia, you know, Isaac, if and when you ever come to Australia and we get to hang out, you'll just see that like there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of societal overlay to those sorts of things. And even like at a campground in Australia, you know, especially Southern Australia, you're not nearly going to get as much wildlife that is like scary, killer, like terrifying, in my personal opinion. And I'm a movie guy, so I've seen all the movies about all the killer animals and all those sorts of things. I've seen them, so I know. But yeah, it's not something nearly like that. Whereas like in Africa, you know, I had a grazed knee. And you know what a staph infection is, right? Like you get an infection. I had a staph infection on my leg. I've never had a graze on my knee that turned into a staph infection, but this is Africa. It's like it tries to kill you. And I had a staph infection on my leg. I ended up taking antibiotics. We had a nurse on our trip, just who was actually one of the participants. This is my second trip my wife and I went on. And I had a staph infection on my leg, and we were staying in, I'm trying to remember where it was, like the Serengeti. There's like a national park where you eat in a dining hall that has cages around it because the food in there can get attacked by like hyenas late at night. And like, I'm asleep with a staph infection and I can smell the staph infection. That's a pretty gnarly thing to say, but you can smell that your like leg is infected and I can hear hyenas barking outside. Like, that's what I mean. Like, I've never been that scared in Australia ever camping. I've never been that scared. Just one night of that. And like, that's, you know, back to The Counselor, that's part of the allure for me, is that it's so nakedly candid about death being at everyone's doorstep in this movie. Like the whole movie is just that you're at death's door, and the people who have any hesitance about that are just clueless.
Yeah, it's the motorcyclist on the road, right? Like, you know, yeah, it's an iconic image. Like, you're going to get to where you're going until something is placed in your path. And then by the time you've seen that something's been placed in your path, it's already around your neck.
Yes.
And it's just like, it's brutal about that. I think it's one of the ways that I do see it as a Ridley Scott film, you know, like I think that he, I can't remember who pointed this out. I remember someone was talking about The Counselor on Twitter. I think it was Bill Chambers from Film Freak Central.
Yeah, love Bill.
Had compared it to the Duelists.
Yes.
And was like talking about it as like, you know, how, and The Last Duel as well, like, you know, him returning to that territory as well. Like, we can put it off as long as we want by talking around it or going through all of these like, these illusions of process of, you know, of parts moving, but it's still going to end with death, and it's still going to end with you in this confrontation. It's going to decide whether you walk away or whether you die. But mostly you're going to die. unless you're Cameron Diaz, who's different. She's just built different in that way.
Built so different in this movie. God, yeah. I love her. Like, when I said that Cameron Diaz, this might be my favorite performance, my other favorite performance of hers, a late 90s performance, like, you know, where she really gets to, I mean, she's such a charmer, like, you know, so many romantic comedies and Night and Day and Charlie's Angels. And the sweetest thing is I hold a soft spot for how ridiculous that movie is. It's fantastic. Gross out, sort of affronting, silly humor, but and really enjoyable. But I love her in Any Given Sunday. I love her in Any Given Sunday. She's just amazing. You know, talking to Charlton Heston and Pacino and Jamie Foxx, she's just holding her own, and they're all dancing to her tune. It's just fantastic. And yeah, I'm so impressed with her in this movie, because yeah, like, she's the one who's aware. She's telling everyone that they're this beautiful, cordial, like, happy, moral life that they're living is a fucking joke. And that's the whole ethos of the movie. And that's one thing that in the extended director's cut, those folks who orchestrate that, the decapitation of the motorcyclist,
yeah,
you know, in the original theatrical cut, you don't hear who they're talking to or who they're following orders from.
Oh, right.
And in this one, you just get like a sliver of her voice on the phone, a sliver. Yeah. And you're like, oh, Malkina, like, these guys who are worried about Malkina should be worried about Malkina. And they're all kind of dismissing her as this, just, you know, sex pot. She does whatever she wants. She's impulsive. You know, she has gynecological sex. You know, Titane had to, you know, got to run after the counselor walked, is what I think. But it's one of those things where you're like, oh, she's just this instrument of like id and all that chaotic stuff and not thinking bigger, but she's actually the architect. She sees an opportunity and she takes it.
Yeah. And I think that Reiner like just completely does not understand that he's being manipulated, because I mean, the guy's obsessed with sex. Like, that's his vice. Like, you know, he can't stop telling stories about these alluring women. But you know what, the image I always think of in, you know, the scene of you know, on the car is like, you know, kind of like a snake, like a cobra, like just kind of moving back and forth before it strikes. Like, and I think that she beguiles him and she enthralls him, but she has him completely in the palm of her hand, or like, and just like captivated, and he feels it like as well in that scene. I think that's why he tells that story about her being, I mean, everyone who's listening to this at this point, I'm assuming, has seen The Counselor and
you
knows would,
this. Everyone knows, I think, even if you haven't seen it, you know the scene. You know the scene we're talking about, where Cameron Diaz has tender marital love with the car.
And it's just like completely, she's like, I'm going to fuck your car. And then she gets up and she fucks the car. And I think that, and he just says, he like, it changes a man to see a thing like that. And and it does.
His line delivery is heroic. He's so good in that scene. And what's even funnier is, I think it's a line in the, I think it might be in both. I'm sorry, I'm a bit of a swirl of both of them, because I watched the theatrical and I watched the extended cut back to back. But there's a moment where Fassbender goes, why would you tell a story like that?
He
just goes, why would you tell me a story like that? And he's like, you asked. I'm gonna just tell you the story exactly as I see it coming together. And that's what it is. And he's so disarmed by her that he can't see the forest from the trees. It's all a technique. Like, we can reflect on it later. It's like her completely beguiling him and doing this. And, you know, she knows what his vices are.
It's just such, it's so great to have him go from Anton Chigurh to Reiner, and to have her come in, because it's just this perfect, he's the character who I think on some level he does understand that she's going to be the death of him, but I think he can't get away. I think that she just is completely insane. I mean, she's a cheetah. She runs faster. Like, you know, she's
playing with him. He's the rabbit. She's just toying with him.
Absolutely. And like, he, I think, likes that in a way, because I think he's like, oh, okay. Like, this is, I think that that's the thing that can get to him. And I think that, you know, this movie is fascinated by the way that, like, in a system that is run by men, women have this interesting power that they can exploit, but that can also really victimize them. And it's just about how they position themselves to that, because either they're going to be consumed and, you know, brutalized by all of these men, like, you know, just participating in all of the cartel violence that's happening, or she can assert power over them. And because they are so or especially Reiner, because he's just like so obsessed with sex. Like, for her to kind of stun him in that way, she finds a way that she can actually be more in control of what's happening than he is. And I don't know, she's just a fascinating character. I do think that she's a bit of a sociopath, because I think everything that she does in this movie is about toying with
and the only person, and that's if the thesis of that she's finally learned, especially not only the technique, but those susceptible to this sexual power that she's been crafting. It's when she goes and visits the priest and tries to make him listen to her debauchery, and he just does not participate. He's just like, no.
Because this is sin. This is like going to lead me to sin. And like, I think, and he says, like, you know, it's like being in love with easeful death.
Yes.
Which is it. Like, you know, and like, I think that she does like know completely what she is doing. And I think that he just, like, that idea for a character like him, who spends so much of this movie speaking about the inevitability of things, the inevitability of fate, and kind of the someone's role in deciding what their own fate is. I think he's like, well, this seems like a pretty fun way to go. I'm going to go. It's like,
Brad Pitt, we talk about Malkina. Yeah. But Brad Pitt even says earlier, he's like talking about cautionary. And he's like, that, you know, the etymology of cautionary is that, like, you know, someone is holding something, like holding something, like a piece of value for someone in this cautionary thing. Like, they're holding a piece of value, lending you out this advice or whatever. And then it's the position that you put both of those people in. You are either the person who's taking the caution, and someone sort of there holding some form of security. And he goes, that's the scary thing, is that what happens if what you're holding is more valuable to them than the caution? Because they don't have to directly be the ones who are out there doing it. And it's like, he tells us right from the beginning, like, this is the way that Malkina gets to orchestrate this thing. All these other people take the risks. All these other people put themselves on the front line. And she just has this micro crew of specialists that are working completely behind the scenes and outside of the purview of anything else, because she's seen the inner workings of this entire operation, and she's just going to eventually self-sabotage them. And the people that they owe and the people who are expecting that they're going to get paid out of all this are just like, they don't need to look beyond it, because there's these big flashy targets that they get to, you know, to manipulate and string up and do these awful things to, that will eventually right the ship. And then she gets to run off into the sunset with all this money. And so, you know, and even with Westray, it's like, oh, he knows that something might go down like this, but I can get out, I can get my money, I can do this. And then that's all it takes. It's just like, oh, I can get out. And it's like, and she even knows, like, I've got to get the guy who thinks he can get out too. And that's what happens.
Yep. And the counselor just thinks that he's like that.
Yes.
I think that's the tragedy of the characters. He just thinks that he's like Westray. And like Westray thinks that he is better than he is too. But he's like, you know, it's like we're playing with very merciless people here. And the counselor's like, oh, it's okay. Because like, he's just not used to the idea of being directly involved, even when he's not used to the idea of being implicated when he's involved.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, it's a fascinating sort of thing to think about, given that Cormac McCarthy is someone who has written so much about the border and has written so much about the American West. And I think that he does see the border as this kind of mythological divide between light and darkness, and between good, between survival and death, maybe life and death more specifically. And so I think that there is this kind of he moves between worlds. Like, the counselor moves like into the cartel space, and he doesn't understand that he's not in his world anymore until it's too late. But I think that the entire movie is just like these characters sitting around waiting to die and talking about how it could happen, and almost understanding that because we've come to this place, it's already too late.
Yes.
And I think that that's what makes so much of the, I think that's what is sort of lost when people are like, well, they're just like talking. It's like, you know,
What are they talking about?
Yeah. It's like, I think that you really need to listen to that. Like, you know, what, and you need to understand that, like, the fact that they're talking is not because this is just like a very loquacious drug dealer. They're having conversations about the existential, just kind of the meaning of everything that's happening, because they're just, and I think that that's something that Cormac McCarthy does, it's so intentionally, is to kind of, you know, create these characters who can discuss these, like, absolutely, like, these innate elemental conflicts. And he really, I think that's what his fascination with is, can we reason through something that is fated, and something, and what would it mean to do so? Like, is there any escape from this through understanding, or is there just clarity?
It reminds me, I think you're so spot on. I love that. Is there any, even when you understand it, is there any escape? So perfectly put. The one thing I'll sort of help us close out with is just referencing another film, a fantastic moment in Antoine Fuqua's Training Day. Great scene with Cliff Curtis, and Ethan Hawke is in a bathtub about to be murdered.
Yep.
And he thinks that he understands that everything is happening, and he's there, and it is just by some pure chance that he happened to show some niceness to Cliff Curtis's, like, daughter that day.
Yeah.
And, like, Cliff Curtis is adhering to all the rules of the world. And it's just like that impulse of, like, I'm going to be merciful is so filled with chance, and life and death is just like skating on those chances, that I think about that scene a lot because of how wonderfully it's put together in the context of that movie, but just how, like, we don't even know sometimes. And what's cool, what's different about The Counselor to Training Day is that there's no small mercy in this movie that could save any of these characters. And that's what's Cormac McCarthy about it. And that's why an older Ridley Scott, an aging director who's kind of seen it all, it's kind of beyond that No Country thing of, like, there may have been a chance, you may have had a choice, you may have been even been able to get it down on a coin toss. And it's like, no, it's inevitable. Like, the fact that you're in this business and the fact that you've crossed this line, there's a lot of people who are past the line who are just, who are biding time. They're in the retirement village before death because they understand how close they are to it all the time. And the counselor is so blissfully unaware of the fact that once he crosses that line, everything in his life is in jeopardy. There's nothing that he can do. And I think that, you know, there's a steadiness and there's a surety to all of the filmmaking. Darius Wolski's great cinematography, like the score, just like everything is so sure. And it's just done so confidently. That's like one of my favorite Ridley Scott directed films, because he just gets all these people to this place and they go through this unfathomable trauma. And he's just so steady and calm in his approach to it, that it kind of matches the calmness of McCarthy's script, and that fusion of those two together, it just, like, it's beautiful.
It's so clean. It's, you know, it's business as usual. I think the, you know, the it starts with, you know, the sort of moving of cargo, the and, like, you know, that sort of with one thing moving from one place to the other, and it ends with the very same sort of image, but it's, you know, with Laura. And I think that, you know, this movie also, the what you're talking about with the cinematography, I think it's such a slick kind of professional sheen and polish that this movie has, because that's the world operating.
Yes.
And, you know, these characters are working to try to stay to keep pace with it and to survive it. But it's, you know, it's going to keep kind of moving forever like this. And just there's always going to be this just savagery to it. And it's interesting because, you know, we've been talking a little bit about New Country for Old Men in comparison to The Counselor as well. And that movie ends with that speech about this kind of perpetual struggle between light and darkness. But then Tommy Lee Jones is like, and then I woke up. He's describing how this like permeates his dreams. But I think that, you know, I think the grand struggle of it is ultimately going to be beyond you.
Yes.
You're going to have to live your life for however long it is, and it's going to end, and that struggle will persist. But I think these characters are so in a way focused on that, that they start to believe themselves in some way to be above it or more powerful within it than they are. They're just specks of dust, you know, moving through.
Well, thank you for us matching some of the philosophical conversations of The Counselor together and getting not too silly about its inherent silliness, because it's just so wonderful. Isaac Thalberg, thank you so much for being a part of the show again. It's so wonderful to talk to you again. People are going to hear this conversation pretty early for our patrons from when we're recording. They're going to hear it kind of at the end of this week. So where is your incredible Sundance coverage coming from to, and where can people find some of your great interviews? Because I think that that's one thing I want to credit you personally. I love reading Isaac's profiles. He's such a prepared, fastidious thinker and a great interviewer, which is why I have so much fun talking to him. So where can people find some of your stuff in this upcoming crazy festival season?
Oh, thank you for saying that, Blake. I really do appreciate it. The interviews that I'm doing for Sundance this year are going to be split between Filmmaker Magazine, the Playlist, RogerEbert.com, and potentially a few things for Letterboxd Journal.
Beautiful.
That's the spread for Sundance. But I guess one thing I would draw attention to is that a couple of weeks ago, I did an interview with Kyle Edward Ball for RogerEbert.com around Skin, the little viral horror movie of the moment. I don't know if that is coming to...
It's coming to Oz, but it's doing like... I think they're testing the waters with like one night onlys, a few night onlys. And I know a couple of exhibitors, like some theater owners and stuff like that, who I'm in regular touch with because of the Q&As and things that I do. And I think that they are overwhelmed with the response to the one night only. So it might be more than one night only, because like I think what their one night only for Skinamarink in Sydney, one of them particularly was like just went gangbusters because of the buzz of this movie. So you know, I've got that interview saved. I haven't read it because I want to see damn Skinamarink. I want to see it before I can read it.
You certainly should. I just draw attention to that one because it's just been so fun to get to write about movies that strange and unconventional for sites like that. That's like one of the things I think I have been quite grateful for recently. I should also mention, just because I wasn't thinking about it, I do have a new byline at crom.com with the intrepid Alex Dowd, formerly of the AV Club.
Awesome.
He's been editing there, and we worked together recently on a piece about a 5-part Willie Nelson documentary that is premiering and is, I don't know if I'm under embargo for this, but it's fantastic. It's, you know, a really beautiful, unconventional approach to a documentary about him. And it is just essentially like a conversation with Willie Nelson. He's just moving back and forth between all of these influences and these anecdotes and these stories from his incredible life. And it is absolutely not one of those documentaries that opens with a fade up on a photograph of Willie Nelson born in this year. It's like, it's, but I had a great conversation with the filmmakers about that. So that's on crown.com as well. But thank you for giving me a chance to plug some stuff.
No, plug away. We love it. I'm going to check that out. I love that. I mean, you have to embrace the storyteller. It's Willie Nelson. Talk about a guy I could listen to talk for 5 hours in anecdotes and stories through time. It's like, that would be the greatest thing of all time.
And that's the thing is that, you know, they spoke with him. He did sit down interviews for this, and it was like the first documentary made with his involvement. And so he does, they did some interviews with him, but it's not just narrated by present day Willie Nelson. It's narrated by Willie Nelson via all of these archival recordings that they found and have been able to kind of put together. And what's so incredible about it is that you really see his perspective evolving on, and his outlook on things evolving over this incredible span of like a 70-year career that he's had. And he says things, he says things that he wouldn't say today. But the way that he says them in the footage that they found, and the way that they use that to help explain one thing that happened, it says so much to how people used to think about certain things and how he used to approach certain ideas and certain social ideas. But it's made with love, but it is this kind of a remarkable, just meandering tour through Willie Nelson's memory.
Can't wait to read that, and also can't wait to see that. Great to talk to you, my friend. I hope to have you back. We're talking for this decade project pieces, me, you know, exhuming old stuff that I've written about before and taking that lens to it, taking a completely different contemporary break lens to stuff that I engaged with really heavily, and I'm excited to do that. And so we'll definitely have you back for a couple more 2013 movies. We've talked about a couple of things now, but great talking to you, and take care and survive the Sundance malaise, and we'll be back talking at least about The Grey. Oh my god. Oh, number one.
I know it's 2011, but I think if I saw it in 2013, it should count.
I definitely watched it in 2013 at home. So we'll make an excuse for that one, but plenty more to come. But yeah, thanks so much for your time, man. You're the best.
Likewise, Blake. Thank you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.